Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to an Empire Podcast interview special. It's been 8 years, would you believe, since Daniel Day-Lewis, the three-time Oscar-winning star of films like There Will Be Blood, Lincoln, My Left Foot, and The Last of the Mohicans, appeared on our screens in Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread. Now, that's a long time to be deprived of the services of one of the greatest actors of all time, and we all thought he'd retired, quite frankly, packing it in for a quiet life, perhaps filled with endless episodes of Countdown and The Chase. Ah, bliss. But not so, for he is back, returning to our screens in An Enemy, which came out on Friday in the UK. In it, he plays Ray, a man who has shut himself away from the world, including his family. But then his brother Jem, played by Sean Bean, arrives at Ray's secluded cabin in an attempt to bring him back into the fold for reasons that will soon become clear. The film not only stars Day-Lewis, who is on typically blinding form, going toe-to-toe in intense scenes with a never-better-been, but is co-written by him, along with his filmmaker son Ronan Day-Lewis, here making his directorial debut in assured fashion. We at Empire were so bowled over by the film that we chose it for our gala screening at this year's London Film Festival in October. And it was the morning after the night before, the morning after the gala, in fact, when Alex Godfrey, who interviewed both Day-Lewis's father and son for a recent issue of Empire, sat down with Daniel Day-Lewis and Sean Bean for the chat you're about to hear, in which they talk about the film, their different approaches to acting, and much, much more. It's a great chat, very loose, very casual, lots of great stuff in here as well. Oh, and do stick around for Alex talking to Ronan Day-Lewis after this. In the meantime, here's Daniel Day-Lewis, Sean Bean. Enjoy.
Daniel Day-Lewis and Sean Bean, welcome to the Empire Podcast. Thank you for joining me. How are you both? You're in the midst of promoting this incredible film. How's it going?
How are you doing?
All right, actually.
Yeah, all right.
It's all bad.
No. You sound surprised, Sean.
Yeah, usually it can be a bit of a grind, these things, but I've thoroughly enjoyed this time around, yeah.
Well, it's a nice atmosphere, really nice atmosphere at the festival, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
really
positive.
Yeah. How did you find last night? It was the film being screened to an enraptured audience? And
yeah, they seemed very warm, the audience, last night.
Yeah.
And we talked to Mark afterwards.
Mark Mode.
Yeah. And it went well, I think.
Yeah. We just had a big meal, haven't we?
Yeah, we did. That's right, because we got whisked away. We got whisked away from sort of the screening.
We took
us to this dinner, and it's a very odd sequence of events. So All these lamb chops kept arriving.
Oh,
and then
really?
We had to go and do a Q&A.
Yeah.
I should just explain for our listeners. So, yes, it was the Empire screening of An Enemy at the London Film Festival last night, and I hosted that and the Q&A afterwards.
That's right, yeah.
Which I enjoyed immensely. And then you two went off to be fed.
Yeah, that's
lots
right.
Lots of red meat.
Yeah, they fed us.
And then we went to the West End.
Leicester Square?
We went to Leicester Square after they fed us.
To do what? To go and sit next to the Mr. Bean station.
All right, Mark Kermode, which was really good.
On a full stomach.
On a full stomach, yeah. But by the way, I said this to you privately, but we were so delighted that you chose our film for the Empire screening. Thanks. Yeah. Alex, I'm really, really delighted.
Well, I'm thank you. That's nice to hear. And it's because we loved the film. You know, I saw it, back in August. It stays with you, that film. I've tried to explain to someone this morning, this doesn't sound like the right word, but there's such a thick atmosphere in the film that really lodges itself in you. I mean, it's such a rich, murky, evocative experience. You know, I mean, it goes in and out. We'll get into it in a minute, but you know, much of it is set in this cabin in the woods, this shed, this hut, and you can taste it watching the film. You know, you can smell it, you can really feel it.
You could taste it being in that shed as well, couldn't you?
Yeah,
sardines.
Taste the stew.
Yeah, it's the stew.
Nice stew you made that day. Lovely.
And there was a lot of particles in the air as well, which probably acted as good diffusion for
particles. Is that a negative?
Ben Forsman's light. Well, because when we were talking to Chris Oddy, the sort of magician who designed it for us, who's
amazing, he did a zone of interest.
That's right.
Just an
amazing, we couldn't believe our luck when he decided he'd go along with us. But so we were just talking about the way in which Ray might have. Initially, the way we wrote it, Alex, was that in the script was that it was a kind of, it was a, like a scavenger's dwelling that made up of bits of wood, you know, both stolen, cut from the forest, some stone, tarpaulin. It was basically like a ramshackle structure. But when we were scouting the locations in Anglesey, on the second day, the first day we were in all this forestry thing, it's not quite right, not quite right. The second day, first thing in the morning, we walk into this small clearing and it was perfect. And there was the shell of the house. Basically just a ruin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we thought, well, and Chris, you know, Chris always sort of thinks in a very practical way. It's like, well, yeah, if you found that in a forest clearing, wouldn't you use that rather than start from scratch? So that became, you know, it just became the right place for Ray. But every detail we went into, including he stuffed a load of to put some insulation in the roof because it would have been bitterly cold in the winter, so a lot of Hessian sacks filled with sort of bits of wool and old blankets cut up and all stuffed, and
but
all that stuff was sort of basically sort of filling the air.
Very meticulous kind of detail. Yeah. And then it allowed it to settle, didn't it, before we started filming it. So you got the elements, you know, the rain and the wind, and it kind of allowed it to settle into this very kind of authentic kind of retreat for
I should explain for the listeners just, so the film is about these two brothers, Ray, Daniel, your character, and Jem, Sean, who haven't seen each other for, I guess, 20 odd years. Yeah. And Ray has intentionally estranged himself, not from you and Jem, but from the outside world, and has confined himself to this place for reasons I won't go into because they reveal themselves later in the film. But so really all I should say is it's about these two brothers who reunite after a long time, and Jem is on a mission to affect change in Ray, I should say. I don't want to go too much into the plot. Yeah. And then much of the film is you two sort of just working that out mentally, spiritually, physically. Daniel, you wrote it with your son Ronan, who's done the most incredible job on the script and the direction of this film. It's a beautiful, as I said on stage last night, it's a beautiful, brutal piece of work. It's really haunting. I know the process was kind of organic. It took you, and I think you first maybe had an idea even pre-2020. Was it 2018 or something? Did you first start thinking about it?
I think it was maybe a bit like, oh, I'm terrible head for dates, but maybe a little bit later than that. But it was certainly the first seed of an idea, which really began just with the desire to try and do something together, no matter what it was. But that would have been 5 or 6 years ago,
Had you, so that would have been maybe 3 years since you'd been out of the game, as it were, I guess. You would have filmed Phantom Thread maybe 2016, I think. It came out 17.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
During that time, had you missed it at all, or was it... What I'm trying to get at, I think, is had that time away of not acting and not even being involved in the film industry, do you think that was necessary to then refuel you and make you ready for when an idea came back?
That's definitely always been true in the past for me, that cycle of work and then moving away from the work. That's always, initially, I suppose, when I was younger, I thought, what's wrong with me? Why do I just like keep working? But I settled into myself. I settled into understanding that if I was going to keep going and I wanted to do it for a long time, this work. It was a vocation from an early age. Yeah. And I thought, well, I haven't got limitless, you know, that your imagination isn't limitless, that it, you know, sometimes you need to let things lie fallow for a bit and re-engage with the world and people and normal things through whatever it could be.
Other interests,
other interests, whatever it might be. So in that sense, it was... It had felt initially like it was that I might not find my way back to it again, but I always have in the past. And really, the mistake was for me to open my mouth about it when I did. But
well, it's good to sort of set your intention out, I guess. Sean, have you just been sort of nodding just there? Have you ever had similar thoughts yourself over your career over the decades? Have you ever thought, I could do with a few years of not doing this?
Sometimes depends what I've just done, you know. Better give this a rest for a while. Oh shit, that what I just but I just kind of lie low for a while. Yeah. But I'm just having a laugh there. And I think what I did was shit. I think I've done some pretty, you know, Nana Game. I think we've all done the Duff film, you know, not through any fault of our own, but perhaps because the project that we first enrolled upon was diluted through by other means, by committee. The original intention of the film, which was so pure and so emotional and heartfelt, was kind of diluted and pulled apart by various other people, maybe their producers or investors or whatever. And what I liked about Daniel and Ronan's film is that it was so pure and so organic. It came straight from the heart, and it was just a joy to read and an absolute joy to perform, especially alongside this fellow and his son. And in regard to having I like having distractions. I don't like to work all the time. You know, I feel as though when I've worked, I have worked. You know, I put my heart and soul into it, I'm not complaining. But you kind of feel tired. You feel as though you've completed something.
Yeah,
I can't go on to something straight away. Maybe when I was younger, I could do that, but I have to let it settle and just let it kind of filter away a little bit, and then look into other. Interest. I like going. I like being outside. I like working with my hands. I like playing the piano now and again. I like different things. Reading. And I think that's so essential for an actor to have to then come back fresh.
Yeah.
And then you think, oh, you rediscover why you wanted to be in this game. You know.
All you really have to offer is yourself. Like, it doesn't matter how far away from, apparently far away from your own character is. You're just offering yourself through that. Life theory you're exploring, and if you're just lurching from one film set to another, what precisely have you got to offer? Because you don't really learn anything on a film set. You're giving out, you're giving what you have to offer, but the learning process happens in between times,
I think.
Well, you told me for those people listening, we met at the end of August, I think it was, in New York to talk about it all. And you said one of the things you'd been doing in your time away was making violins.
Yes. Yeah.
How is that similar in any way to what you do? Because I can imagine when you're concentrating on something that specific, you must get into almost a meditative state, into a zone where because that's no mean feat, building a violin. How was that for you, and how did it help you as a person?
About as challenging as anything I've ever attempted in my life. What it has in common, you sort of hit the nail on the head there, is that it's just the sort of the loss of yourself through work. It's, you know, it's not the abandonment of the self, but the loss of the self. In other words, the hands on the clock keep turning, but you're unaware of the passage of time. And that's the beauty of the arts, isn't it?
Yeah.
You may wake up and suddenly you're 68 years old or everything. I want to say, what just happened?
Yeah.
But those periods, when you invest yourself in a certain kind of way in the work, be it, you know, making a violin or acting, whatever, it is a form of meditation in that you ceased, you It's odd. It's like it is the letting go of the ego. It's not. It's the character. It's your, because you live with your, you think of yourself as being your character, but that's not yourself. Yourself is your soul, your spirit. It's not the same thing. And your character is just a sort of like a thing that you've become over the years through circumstances and through DNA or whatever. But that's not, I don't think, at the essence who you are.
Yeah.
But it's a tremendous relief to let go of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have the same feeling?
I do, yeah. It's like you put on a persona or a mask for a certain thing. Literally in acting you do it, but you also do it as a person. And then when you get away from that, or take time to get away from that, and as you said, it's your soul, it's a soulful experience to have time on your own. I like time on my own, you know?
It's essential.
Now and again, you know.
Yeah.
It is essential. Recharge your batteries and find out, you know, you think out what who am I, what you know, what was I interested in, what makes me tick, and you know, and then go back and feel excited about it all again. I think that's probably similar to what you were describing about the violin, but you know, to make a violin and to do the things that you did, it requires 100% concentration.
Absolutely.
It's impossible to think of anything else. It's like playing
impossible.
A musical instrument.
No.
You can't be thinking about something else when you're doing that. And it's so great to get away and then come back, and you learn so much quicker. I find learning lines is much.
I mean, in terms of the actual, the process itself, it's the antithesis, I think, of like what we do as in the performing arts, because that's got a wildness to it. It's the unconscious that really, and the imagination that informs everything, if it's working properly. But making things, and Sean makes things as well, and he's a great gardener too. And it,
what do you make, Sean? Sorry to
also
interrupt.
Also, bird box. I kind of make things. I'm making a big path. I'm planning out a new kind of aspect of the garden in order to be able to get some stuff from one place to another, in order to be able to do that, I have to build a small bridge and a path and plan it out. And I take great interest in that. Yeah. I find it fascinating, probably because it's so far removed from the imaginative. Well, you're still obviously using your imagination, but you're not performing in front of someone. You just, I like it. It's so different. It's so far away, and I need something to be so far away from what I usually do as my job.
Yeah.
In order to kind of function properly in my life, and so use your hand. And gardening, and you can be doing something so tiny, you know, planting a few seeds in the greenhouse and doing this and that, and it's so distant from what you do, but you can come snap back into
it's an antidote, isn't it? Because it's quantifiable. It's like what we do is not, it's a matter of taste, whether people like us or don't like us. It's a matter of taste. It's not about the quality of what we're doing, probably, for the most part. It's just some people want to look at our faces or something. But when you're making something, you look at it and you think, well, that's good. That's rubbish. It's like you know what it is.
You know
if it's a good thing that you've made, and you can, the quality of it is there. It's undeniable. It's if you run a race and you come in first, you've won the race. If you come in second, you're doing all right. But this is all kind of like
speculative, isn't it?
You can measure the degree of success in the thing that you've done, and so it's a good antidote in a way.
Because
we're just sort of working in unknown terms all the time.
Chasing
ghosts.
What you do, hands up. There's certainty to it. This is all speculation acting. You don't know anybody. Yeah. You know.
Well, let's talk about the acting. We talked about it briefly on stage last night. Sean, you said, we talked at the beginning of this conversation about the hut or the shed, whatever you want to call it. It's kind of this demonic alcove that Ray lives in. I said to you before, Danny, it's almost like the manifestation of his mind, his mental state.
Yeah, it's a good image, yeah.
It's a foreboding and forbidding place. And Sean, I think you were saying something on stage last night I mean, obviously, you weren't involved in the years of preparation. You turned up on the film to act, and were thrown into that hut, right into the thick of things. And you said, did you say it was almost like an intentionally hostile environment for your character to be put into? And
Yeah.
Get on with it. What was that experience like?
It was good. It was like being on the set for the first. That's always kind of a, you know, an unnerving experience being on any set and starting the first day. I don't know. I always find it. It's like first day of starting a new school or something. You know, there's that kind of trepidation, that kind of queasy feeling in your stomach, which I think is quite positive, I think, you know, to an extent. You know, as long as you don't fall apart. And I like the fact that I felt like that because it was the first day. And when I first entered that hut and saw him and I saw his surroundings, and that kind of makes you feel a bit queasy. It was very Spartan, but he knew where everything, you knew everything, any little thing, his tin of sardines were all nicely stacked everywhere. And, you know, it's a man of precision and discipline, but also a man of kind of wild kind of emotions, and which was quite intimidating when I first walked into that arena, as it were.
Because, so Daniel, I take it you were in character. This is what I mean. Have you met before?
Yeah. I mean, not in the immediate period of time before we started shooting, except, you know, say hello and how's it going. But Sean, you know, a good few months before we started, Sean came over and we had a few days together in Ireland.
Okay.
Which was lovely.
And
it wasn't even about... Really, it's just sort of finding that ease with a person, you know. I've always been, not having grown up with brothers.
Yeah.
I've found brotherly figures over the years in my life and really enjoyed that imagined relationship. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like that with Sean coming over. It just felt,
I'm like that. I ain't got no brothers, and a lot of my family are coming from women, and so it was. Of course, you find kind of brotherly instincts with friends and that, but it was particularly interesting in this instance to get together with Daniel. We're a similar age and we have similar interests, and it was great to have that time together. We didn't necessarily rehearse, it was just to kind of get to know each other, feel for each other, and it was such a great experience.
And you know, brothers fight, and I don't want to spoil the context, but you two do come to blows at one point in this film. It looks very convincing. I mean, there's a lot of intense sort of physical wrestling between you. I mean, there's you're drunk dancing at one point. There's a beautiful score and soundtrack on this film. But I believe, I think Ronan said somewhere that actually on set he was playing Black Sabbath. What was that like, you two just...
Rest in peace,
What was it like thrashing around to Black Sabbath?
Oh, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I was tempted to get really drunk, and I'm glad I stopped short of doing that, because just doing what we did, I was absolutely... And I'm fairly fit, but I was genuinely wrecked at some point doing that.
Because it was reckless, wasn't it?
That
ties you up.
We ended up on the floor a few times. I don't think it all ended up in the movie.
And there was always that threat of violence in it. But there's always like almost. You know, like the Sex Pistols, so the audience when they first saw the Sex Pistols, they were kind of dancing, kind of hitting each other.
Yeah, there's never the biker dance they used to do with the thumbs tucked in and they'd be doing
that.
There was a lot of that, but sometimes you'd get it wrong and you just like wallop.
We collided a few times.
Proper headbang.
Morning. It mornings work that.
Yeah.
It's not a bad way to earn a living, right?
No, not a bad way.
No.
All right, well, we've got to wrap up, but that's it's a great note to end on. Thank you so much, both of you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah.
Thanks.
Cheers. All right, that was Alex Godfrey talking to Sean Bean and Daniel Day-Lewis about An Enemy. And now here is Alex's interview with Ronan Day-Lewis, in which they talk about the film, of course, and also what it's like to not only direct your dad, but direct your dad when he is in character. Enjoy.
Ronan Day-Lewis, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, welcome to the Empire Podcast. It's good to see you again.
Great to see you too.
We met in August.
Yes.
In New York, which was very exciting. I'd seen the film, a couple of weeks earlier. And as you know, I absolutely loved it. And it was incredible to talk to you and your dad about it. We chose it as the Empire LFF screening. It was so we're talking the day after we screened that. That was incredible. I mean, it seemed incredible For me, the audience seemed to lap it up. How was it for you?
Yeah, it was incredible. Like, I almost wish I had actually been watching it, because it felt like the energy from the audience felt amazing afterwards. But yeah, it was such an honor that you guys chose it as the film this year, and just such an incredible energy.
Do you know what? You could feel it in the room. You could feel that it went down really well, and people were really engaged, and nobody left their seats.
That's amazing. that's great to hear. Yeah.
So, and then earlier today, so your dad did a career talk.
Yes.
The stage on NFT One, and then you joined for half an hour at the end.
Yeah.
You were in the audience. As
yes.
Well.
Yeah.
What was it like? I mean, anemone stuff aside.
Yeah.
What was it like for you being part of the audience, seeing your dad being interviewed and going through his life and career and talking? What was that, weird?
It was trippy. Yeah. I kept forgetting that they were going to talk about anemone too, because I was just so absorbed in, you know, these clips from like My Left Foot and The Boxer and just all these great films he's done, that I was like, I don't know, it was surreal when I'd kind of remember that when they'd play a clip from anemone, and I was like, oh, this I don't know, it was a pretty out of body experience, honestly, to watch that. And yeah, I thought it was just such a fascinating conversation. I was really happy I got to witness it.
He's a good storyteller, your dad.
And yeah,
I,
yeah.
Dare I ask, was, because I, you know, he's talked a lot about the importance of separating, you know, when the kids, and you were one of them growing up, of separating his work from his life, you know, and the fact that sometimes it's been hard to completely do that is contributes to the fact that he's not acted for a few years, a couple of times. I imagine he hasn't over the years just brought his homework with him when he's not working. So was there stuff in that interview that you didn't know? Were there things he talked about that you hadn't heard before?
Yeah, I think there were. I mean, it's funny because some of the things he talked about, I feel like I had heard, but not through him. I'd heard through the kind of mythology, of the way people had talked about, you know, the work he did, like his process on My Left Foot, for instance. I feel like I'd heard some of those stories, but it was really interesting to hear them from his perspective. And yeah, there were definitely some things that I hadn't known about. Cause I feel like we have talked over the years quite a bit about, more in recent years, like as, you know, not when I was a kid, but about how some of his experiences on these films. But yeah, no, it was, yeah, I thought it was such a like, I loved how detailed the conversation was. It felt like it really had space to go into all these kind of nooks and crannies of those experiences.
So you joined on stage for the end the end part of it, and you talked about some of the things you've been influenced by and seeing Kes at a young age, and you talked about how much David Lynch has informed you.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about that. David Lynch is, you know, one of my all-time heroes, obviously.
Yeah.
I had the fortune of interviewing him a couple of times for Empire, which
was amazing.
Absolute dream.
Wow.
He was just one of my favorite people on the planet.
Wow.
And I wanted to find out about your history with him as a fan, and what films you watched and when, and how that informed you as a person and as a filmmaker, because clearly it's influenced anemone.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I think the first film I saw by him was, my mom showed me Eraserhead. So she started at the beginning.
Really? How young were you? Because that's the...
I must have been like 19 or something.
Okay.
So I was old. I wasn't that young, but she showed it to me, and I don't think I at first quite knew what to make of it, but I loved it. And then she tried to show me Blue Velvet. And the first time I watched Blue Velvet, I actually couldn't stand, I couldn't watch it.
It's a tough watch.
A kind of visceral experience of it. And then I came back to Blue Velvet a couple of years later and rewatched it, and it immediately became like my favorite film of all time. Like the second time I'd seen it. And that, like, I guess that polarity between the first time I watched it and the second time, just, there was something exhilarating about that. And I just got so... I started watching some interviews with him, and just the way he would talk about his work also just was so, felt kind of spiritually like enlightening or something. I just became so hooked on his I guess methodology of how to make things. Yeah.
And it's interesting in the case of Anemone because it straddles sort of tones and yeah. worlds really delicately. Because on the one yeah. hand, it's a very intimate human drama right. about a family and essentially two brothers. And so and I would say the majority of the film takes place in this evil cabin in the
yeah.
woods.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
at the same time, you do have some more abstract and surrealist imagery. And I know some of yeah. it has made itself known before in paintings and work you've done
yeah,
before.
Yeah.
But that's obviously come from some of those Lynchian influences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that is that something that's just so much a part of you that it just needled its way into it all?
Yeah, I think it really was. It like the images that kind of were already I was already kind of fixated on in paintings, I think came really subconsciously and then when it came time to work on the film, I think I was really just instinctively drawn to a lot of the same images and kind of feelings that I'd been thinking about in the paintings. But I do think watching David Lynch's films and just hearing him talk about them liberated me to just think, to allow for more of those abstractions to exist in a film like Anemone, which could be done in a far drier, more kind of kitchen sink
yeah.
way. But I think just like liberating myself to kind of think about, as he describes it, kind of what's hidden and because I think that like in reality we're constantly actually experiencing both the world in two ways. Like we're experiencing just what the visible reality, and then we all have these inner lives and these daydreams and these constant kind of inner experiences that are kind of superimposed on the outer experiences. And I think that film as a medium is kind of uniquely qualified to be able to depict that. So it just felt like, why yeah. not let those two sides of reality kind of bleed together?
But they do work together really well yeah. in the film, because even though much of the narrative is about, you know, real things that happened and trauma and family and violence and cycles of violence, you've got this beautiful sort of existential imagery going on. You play a lot with the landscapes, with the elements, with the weather. You've got these foreboding shots of the sort of wind shooting across the sand yeah. and these trees swirling and almost like a god's eye view of things.
Yeah, yeah.
But even with some of the down-to-earth conversations that are happening, it's like the film is still grabbing at something more cosmic at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
So it all coheres.
Yeah, I think a lot of as you said, I think a lot of the way we ended up trying to marry those two things was through the actual physical world and giving like this sense of portent to the trees and the skies and just the physical environment in the way we photographed it and also actually in the sound design, because as you're saying, like in the in some of those scenes where they're just in this enclosed interior space, like always having the sense of wind outside kind of battering yeah. the hut and
yeah.
you know, intermittent rain and just always I love the way you put it, just those constant reminders that there's something bigger, something like more cosmic kind of behind the or surrounding the human drama that we're looking at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of the human drama, something you said to me, we touched on very briefly when we spoke in New York a couple of months ago. You wrote this with your dad, and it started off with the idea to write something about brothers, and then it sort of organically, you know, started growing into
yeah.
you know, a bigger family story, and then you've got, you know, the troubles it's informed some of it. But also, we talked a lot about fathers and sons, and talked about your grandfather a bit. And you said that it was never meant to be a personal story, but at some point during the process, it became clear that it was quite personal here yeah. and there, and you both decided to embrace it.
Yeah.
Can
yeah.
you say anything more about that? What sort yeah. of things got into it?
Yeah, I think my personal way into it was really just just the idea of brotherhood and my personal experience of being a brother, and just the,
yeah.
I guess, just the volatility and but also just the beauty and the all the kind of range of human emotion that's contained in that relationship that I think was that was the comfort for me going in, even though because the actual circumstances of the story and like these two characters are so distant from my own experience. But I felt I was worried at first that I wouldn't really be able to find enough of a personal way in. And then I think actually the addition of when we first has spent a scene alone with Brian in his bedroom, I think that opened up a whole new perspective of just generationally of this like younger person who's kind of fascinated with the mystery of his parents' past life. And that was something that I felt like I could kind of understand on a deep level that I think helped me make the film a lot more personal than it would have been if it was our original intention of just keeping it contained to the cabin. And that ended up also just widening the scope in general, but also just in terms of the kind of introducing another perspective that felt like I could find my way into more easily.
What was it like as a director as well, directing actors? I mean, this is your first feature.
Yeah.
You've got an incredible, I mean, on stage last night, I mean, I couldn't, but you know, you've got Daniel Day-Lewis, you've got Sean Bean, you've got Samantha Morton. These are all the best of the best.
I know.
The best to ever do it, right?
Yeah.
And they're all a game in this film. But also, you know, much of it, like I say, is two-hander between Daniel and Sean.
Yeah.
And they are extremely different, contrasting characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very different performances and from what I speculate and believe, very two different actors in terms of how they approach the work.
Yeah.
What was it like for you navigating that, like being in that location and directing these two forces who are so different to each other? Because I imagine they both have to be approached differently.
No, definitely. I think, it was kind of... I think that both of their, both of them, even though they approached the work in such different ways, like had such a palpable inner life of the character that it actually helped me kind of get inside that world and almost coexist with them in it more than explicitly kind of direct them, even though it was obviously, you know, helping both of them in different ways kind of find their way to the feelings and the kind of rhythms of these scenes. But I think with my dad it was helpful because we had obviously, having written the script together, we'd had so many of these extremely detailed conversations about the character that it sort of grew like over the course of like 4 years into this person that we both understood, really had a really deep shared understanding of by the time we got on set. So that kind of, that a lot of the work had been done before we got there in that case, which was really helpful. And then with Sean, I think what was so amazing to me about his performance is that it's just a masterclass in what to do with silence and just with listening. And so many of the scenes, he's basically in this torture chamber with Ray. I mean, not so many of them, but especially the priest scene where he's just kind of glued to the spot, basically being performed to in this extremely volatile, kind of aggressive way. And so it was like working with him to kind of find what the least he could do physically was while portraying this kind of epic emotional journey within this one scene was something we worked on. And yeah, it was really just trying to kind of meet each actor where they were and try to give them what they needed to really hypnotize themselves into the world. And with Sam Morton, it was really interesting because she was so detailed about we worked together to kind of figure out a very detailed backstory for her character that we wrote down. But then also actually for her, I think it was really important, actually similarly to my dad, just in terms of her house, the actual physical environment, like we would just go through the house and she'd be like, she wouldn't have that. Like that would be this,
oh, really?
You know, this thing would be over there. Yeah. Just extremely, extremely specific kind of shaping of the actual physical environment, which I think then had a big, I think for her, it was all just in an effort to kind of create the right circumstances for her to really be inside, like sink into Nessa, and also just in terms of everything, her costume, her, you know, what, you know, her nails, like all these really minute details that I think became this great kind of armature for her to just give her best performance. And I think also with all of them, it was just I was really trying to make sure to tell the difference of when I could be of help and when I needed to just shut up and let them like find things of their own accord, because so much of it is also about them finding their own private inner life for the character, that it's like, if you're too intrusive with that, you're almost actually doing more harm than good.
Well, and how does that play out specifically with your dad? Because as we know, he's fully in character, yeah, and he stays in character.
Yeah, yeah.
I wondered what that is like for you as a director, because then how does that play out? Because are you directing Ray?
Yeah, directing Ray. Yeah.
Let me try and get into the weeds, because Ray is not an actor. Ray is, to all intents and purposes, that character.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're directing, you're trying to get a performance out of the actor.
Yeah.
So what's the practical, what does that mean for you as a director in that set? How do you make that?
Yeah, well, that was actually something I was pretty nervous about going in, even though I'd had like so many conversations with my dad leading up to it about the character, that like I didn't want to, like, how do I direct you without stepping on your toes and destroying the illusion?
Yeah,
you know, and
exactly.
But when we got on set, I think the pleasant surprise for me was that he was actually so, like, it was this weird paradox where he was both Ray, undeniably Ray, but then also was able to have this objectivity about the dance with the camera and the kind of the technical requirements of it, as long as they didn't get too intrusive. And that was always just the dance and the kind of tightrope to walk. But we didn't do a ton of rehearsal, but we would each evening before the next day's shoot, we would go into the space together with Ben, the DP, and we would just basically walk through the scene and he'd kind of figure out how he would move through the space, but we'd also talk to him about, you know, the shot list and, you know, what we were hoping to achieve. And so it was really, I was actually really relieved at how collaborative it was in that way.
Yeah, because I guess you could run the risk of you're asking Ray Stoker to do something and you say, fuck off.
No, exactly. And sometimes, and it's like, sometimes it would be like that and it would just be, and that was, but in the long run, that was always for the best.
Yeah.
Whenever something felt like it went against his instincts, like he was always like, he knows his character like better obviously than anyone else to such a deep degree that he's always right when it comes to staging a scene. So it's like when you're trying to figure out that choreography, I guess, of the scene. So it was, I think it was it was kind of just, we had to just go about it intuitively and just find that like, for the most part, I think we managed to really dance that dance without it encroaching on his process, which I was relieved about, because I was like, I didn't want to be a nuisance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a real baptism of fire for you.
Yeah. 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 Exactly.
You're probably ready for anything after that.
Yeah. Right.
I want to ask about, I don't want to spoil the context of it, but there is a fight scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very convincing on screen. And because of some of the stuff that we've just been talking about,
yeah,
I imagine it was quite authentic. I'm sure you don't want your actors getting hurt.
Yeah.
What is the reality of that? Was there fight choreography, or did you just let those two guys go at it? Was there any damage done? Because it looks like it.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad to hear that. But yeah, the idea was to really try to make it seem as unchoreographed and messy as possible. But it was actually hyper choreographed.
Right.
Like
that's the responsible thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was to a point. I mean, it was like the way we shot it was pretty free compared to a lot of the other stuff we had done, but as far as the actual movements, it was we worked with a sound coordinator to really find a way for it to feel kind of unhinged and also kind of pathetic, because we didn't want it to be a fight, one of those kind of, we didn't want it to feel flashy or impressive in any way, the violence in it. It should feel kind of abject and they're slipping around in the mud, and there's something kind of sad about it as well, and kind of funny in a way, even though, I mean, to me at least,
kind of,
I guess if you're watching it for the first time, it is pretty brutal.
Yeah.
But yeah, we wanted to feel really unpredictable. So that was, yeah.
So no one got punched in the face?
No one got punched in the face.
Wow.
But I'm really glad to hear it. It seemed like they did.
It feels like it. It's quite shocking.
Yeah. Sean did a great job of selling that first punch also, and the way he reacts.
The way he reacts to it, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really hard. Yeah.
What was it like for you? How long was the shoot, by the way?
It was 35 days, shooting days. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. What was it like coming to the end of it after, three, four, five-year journey going through? I mean, you cooked it up with your dad. You wrote it together. He was obviously instrumental to the film alongside you, and then you're directing him.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell me about the final day of shooting? What was it like putting an end to it? And also, with everything we've just been saying, what was it like saying goodbye to Ray Stoker and then just being able to have a relationship just with your dad again?
Yeah,
and is that something that happened as soon as you finished shooting, or is that more of a gradual letting go of things?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was the last day was really, it was really emotional. Like we had saved, he had actually hurt his leg doing the dancing scene earlier on, which I felt terrible about.
All right, so he got hurt not from the fight, but from the dancing.
No, from the dancing scene. So we ended up having to switch the schedule around and push all of the more like action-oriented stuff to the end of the shoot, like the running and all the hail stuff and, you know, the fight and all that.
Yeah.
So I think if I remember right, actually the fight was on the last day.
Was that intentional in case anyone did get that?
Right. It was just like, yeah, but that we joked about that leading up to it. We were just like, yeah, well, at least we'll have gotten it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was funny because it was just like, it feels so weirdly anticlimactic. I think the last shot we got with my dad and it was him, like, it was like a cutaway of him tying his shoe or something, like, which didn't end up in the film. But it was like, there was something like really strange about that being the last shot of him. But it was really emotional. And then we got a shot after that. I think the last shot was actually the close-up of the destroyed anemones at the end of after the hail scene, which felt kind of apt. And then afterwards it was kind of a return to normalcy with him pretty quickly, and that was definitely, I was like, I had almost forgotten that was I've gotten so used to Ray, like on and off set, that it was actually kind of a shock to hear his normal voice again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was suddenly like, oh, right. This is how my dad normally sounds and is. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you miss Ray, or was it good to see him go?
I think it was a great experience with Ray, but I don't know if I would want Ray to extend forever. But it was, but yeah, I mean, there was aspect, like even when we were shooting, there was aspects of Ray that he'd carry home, but it was like, he was also him. So it wasn't like we were actually, you know, existing with Ray fully but it was definitely, it was both a relief, but also sad to see him go, for sure.
I'm sure. Was it sad? I better wrap up because we're running out of time. But you know, your dad has always spoken about that. One of the reasons that he stopped acting before this was that he said he always found it hard to finish a film because it felt like a bereavement for him.
Yeah.
Did you feel that at all with this one? Did it feel like a loss when it was all done?
Yeah, I think I'm feeling the loss actually now, because it was like after shooting it, there's definitely a sense of loss. But then you go back, you go into the cutting room, and there's this illusion that you're spending so much time with the actors and with these characters, even though you're like, it is an illusion. But I think, yeah, you're so caught up in that work and so close to it that I think it's really only now, almost like talking about it feels like, in detail, feels like it is almost the grieving process of it in a way. So it's interesting. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, congratulations. Yeah. It was worth it. It's a beautiful film.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Alex.
And that was Ronan Day-Lewis talking to Alex about Anemone. And that is it for this interview special. Anemone is out now in cinemas across the UK, so give it a whirl if you haven't already, and keep them peeled for more interview specials coming your way right soon, as well as a regular pod which hits every Friday. And if you want to see the Empire Podcast live, we are coming back to King's Place in London for an epic celebration of our 700th episode on Friday, January 9th next year, in case you're wondering. Tickets are on sale now at kingsplace.co.uk, and they are going pretty darn quickly, folks, so if you want to be there for a whole ton of film-related fun, you'd best get your skates on. Okay, that is enough from me. I'm off to watch a whole bunch of episodes of Countdown and The Chase. Daniel Day-Lewis doesn't know what he's missing. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.